Hello and welcome to the latest MBW podcast, supported once again by Sound Exchange, which has paid out more than $4 billion to labels and artists to date. Our guest for today's podcast is one of the most in-demand pop songwriters of the current era. Justin Tranter had a huge 2016, as a number of songs he co-created entered the stratosphere. Justin Bieber's Sorry was the most played music video on Vevo, with over 1.8 billion views. DNCE's Cake by the Ocean became a sustained global smash, clocking up just under 500 million Spotify plays to date. Justin has also worked on Gwen Stefani's US number one album, This Is What Truth Feels Like, as well as collaborating with the likes of Britney Spears, Fifth Harmony, Kygo and John Legend. But Justin's career hasn't always been defined by success. His glam rock band Semi-Precious Weapons were signed and dropped by labels no less than four times, despite winning praise and patronage from Lady Gaga. We talked to him about Spotify, the diversity of the industry, and what it takes to be a hit songwriter today. You obviously had a number of years, which we'll come back to, as an artist. And then you had the years where you're trying to make it as a songwriter, you're trying to get picked up, and now you are like a go-to songwriter for the music business. How are you dealing with the different pressures that come with enjoying that status?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm dealing with it quite well. It was such a long, long fight to get where I am. I've been trying to be successful in the music business since like 1998. So to finally find that success, 19 years later is pretty amazing and pretty weird. But I'm just so grateful and so happy for it that I think I'm handling it pretty well, to be honest. I think that if it wasn't such a long fight to get here, and if I didn't know what it felt like to fail miserably multiple times, it might be a little bit harder to deal with because, you wouldn't feel worthy of it or you wouldn't feel prepared, or you wouldn't be as grateful, for it as you should be. But I am just so insanely grateful and so insanely excited that, the world hears some of the songs that I write, that I'm handling it pretty well.
Can you give us an idea of your sort of working day, what your typical week is, and how much effort you continue to put in? People might think that you've taken your foot off the gas after a few hits, but that's not the case.
No, fuck that. No, there's no slowing down. Most importantly, I really love what I'm doing. And every day is so different that, knock on wood, I haven't gotten burnt out yet. But I mean, I would say I normally am in about 10 sessions a week. So that means like I normally work, Monday through Saturday, but sometimes on Sundays. And, most of those days are double session days. So I'll start my first one at 1 p.m. and then I'll start a second one at, 7 or 7:30 or 8 p.m.
What would you say has been the secret, above anything else, to turning your career around so dramatically since Semi-Precious Weapons?
Yeah, I would say that the big secret to turning my career around, I think there's three big secrets. One, the world is still shockingly homophobic. As we can see, especially what's happening here in America, Donald Trump continues to, every single person he puts on his cabinet or his vice president, they've all come to political fame because of their resistance towards equal rights for gay people. So I think a lot of it is, the world wasn't ready, still isn't ready for a big, loud, gay, homo, pop star or rock star, whatever the hell you want to call it. When you look at the openly gay stars that we have, and I'm so grateful we have them, and they're all so brilliant, but it's a much calmer human than I am, whether it's Sam Smith or whether it's Joyce Vaughn or, it's a much different, my band was very sexual and very over the top and very in your face. And I just don't think the world was really ready for that. But then two, the other secret is my favorite thing to say nowadays is focus on creation, not attention. And let the creation be the goal and making the best music or art or TV show or whatever it is that you do, make that the focus, not getting attention from it. And then I think the third biggest thing is just Katie Vinton, my publisher, she just put me to work, and it was the first executive relationship that I've ever had, or business relationship, or whatever you want to call it. First relationship I had of someone who really put me to work, and I love to work. So it was a pretty amazing win-win situation. I just had this woman in my life who every single day, if I wanted to write, she would find a place for me to go. And so I think those are the three main things that changed drastically.
I know this is a question that you've been asked by friends and peers of yours, but it sort of links to the, you mentioning Katie there. Why do you need A&R? What does it bring to your life?
You need an A&R, I'll just speak on the publishing side of that, is that one, you need someone to find you work. You know, that's like the bare bones of it, is you just need someone that's going to go and fight for you and find you work. But then two, you need, you know, someone who's hopefully, you know, it's hard to come by, but it's possible. I found it in Katie. You need someone who puts you to work, but also puts you to work smartly. And they find the sessions that they know you'd excel in, and they are open with you about what they think your strengths are as a writer, and they pair you with people, to even be more blunt, they are honest with you about what your weaknesses are, and they pair you with people that can fill in the gaps that you need to make sure that you have the best chance of writing the best song possible. And so that's where the A&R really comes into play. And, you know, early on when I first started doing the pop stuff and writing for other people, you know, just to have someone to send your songs to and be, you know, politely honest with you and say, this one's good, this one isn't good, this one's good, and this is why I think it's good. And, oh my God, like, you're, for me personally, you know, your concepts and your lyrics are so amazing. And like the weird melodies, alternative melodies that you do are really awesome, but we should probably pair you with someone, you know, that has a little bit more down the middle pop melody so that when you guys combine it, you know, get something that the whole world can understand. You know, so that's the importance of the A&R is someone that will put you to work and someone that will also be creative and be honest with you to make sure that you are in the best situations possible every single day.
Obviously, pop is what you're best known as in the songwriting sphere. Are you surprised that your career has veered towards that direction? And would you like to move into other areas in the future?
No, I love being in pop because pop just means that it's popular. And pop just means that it's as clear and as focused as possible. At least to me, that's what it means. So, you know, if I do something for DNCE, it's obviously much different than something for Bieber. Or if I do something for Selena, it's much different than, you know, doing something with Gwen. You know, pop is just so broad, especially nowadays. I think it just gets more and more broad that I'm fine with living in the pop world, especially because I think I'm definitely like, you know, I'm one of the weirder people in pop music, personally and creatively. I like where I am. I think that it feels really good. It feels really natural for me. And, you know, whether I'm working with someone who is so emotional, but also, you know, melodically, Julia is like just a pop genius, you know. So you have this emotional pop genius and pair it with me. And in that world, I can just sort of focus things and clean things up and, you know, basically be like the most active sounding board and participant ever, or, you know, in things like DNCE where me and Joe can really dig in together and, you know, create this whole thing from scratch that's a lot weirder than most pop music. You know, everywhere's different, but I'm really happy to be where I am.
You had obviously a supportive relationship with Lady Gaga in your artist days, but what do you make of where her career has gone since then, and are you open to collaboration now you're on the sort of side of the industry fence that you're on?
I think, you know, what Gaga has done is so amazing, and to, you know, our story is so cool of, you know, some of her first shows ever as Lady Gaga were opening for my band, and then we went and ended up opening for her when she was the biggest star in the world. You know, just a crazy full circle moment that just continues to happen. And we actually did write one song together, I would say 9 months ago or something, and, you know, for her. And it was a really cool thing. And she was so happy to see me in my new element and see me do what I do. And it was amazing. But then, you know, she as a brilliant artist always do, she, you know, found this new direction and was working with Mark Ronson, and you know, the whole trajectory of what the album was going to be changed. And I think it, you know, she's interested in is making like the most bold art possible, and she does that at every turn. And sometimes those are big, huge pop hits, and sometimes those are really personal, introspective singer-songwriter moments. And I think whatever she thinks is the right move is obviously working. I mean, the woman has been at the top of the game in like 17 different genres, and she's only been famous for 8 years. So it's pretty impressive.
Talking about Semi-Precious Weapons, I think I'm right in saying that you were signed 4 times and dropped 4 times. I want to ask what that did for your morale and your ego and your motivation, but also the very basic question of, was there a time where you genuinely nearly gave up and everything that's come since would never have come to be?
Yeah, there were, you know, the being signed 4 times and dropped 4 times is definitely a very interesting thing to go through. You know, I think, I mean, a lot of people trying to be, you know, artists in this industry, they definitely, a lot of them do get signed and dropped at least once, but 4 times is pretty special. But I'm really good at seeing the positive and everything. And I just kept looking at it as like, even though we've had things that are technically failures, there's clearly something about what we were doing that people still found exciting, and they still thought that there was something there, and there was some way that they could hopefully make money off of what we were doing. So I always just focused on that. Like, even though they know that we've been dropped 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, they always want more. They always think that there's something more there. So I always just focus on the positive of it. And then in terms of quitting, there was, I would say about, and it wasn't necessarily because of the music business or because of the band. There was just a moment there were some people on our team, not in the band, but like in the business realm. There was a person in the business realm of our team that was so difficult, so heartbreaking. And, you know, we were starting to have a song climb at alternative radio, and we had never tried to go to radio before. And, you know, I just kept getting phone calls at least once a week, saying, well, alternative radio is, you know, even more homophobic than pop, which is true. Alternative radio is super bro-y. And, you know, you need to be less gay. And you just posted this picture of you and Adam Lambert, and you look even more feminine than Adam Lambert, and we can't have that. And I was like, well, but I am more feminine than Adam Lambert, so I don't know what to tell you. So it was almost, the thought of quitting was just because I couldn't fucking handle those conversations anymore. But then we'd play a show, and even if it was a small private show, you know, which we ended up doing a lot of in LA just when we were not on tour, you know, there'd just be these people there that were just so happy and so excited to see us perform and hear what I had to say that I was like, well, I'm just going to keep fucking going. But yeah, there was definitely moments. And then, but once Katie came into my life, I saw that there is hope and that there are people in this business that actually do their fucking job, which I think is, you know, it's hard to find, and it does make you want to quit. You know, my favorite thing, I always joke about, like, the music business complains that the internet ruined the music business. And I'm like, the internet is the greatest tool since the wheel. If you people, you executives, couldn't figure out how to use it, that means you're fucking dumb. It doesn't mean that it ruins you. So, that, you know, the idea of quitting definitely crosses your mind, because there's all these people, these business people that are supposed to take care of artists and take care of writers, and they don't. And then finding Katie made me realize, wait, if I just keep going and I keep fighting, you know, not only is Katie going to help me, but there's got to be more people that can actually, that believe in the right way to do this. And since then, you know, the A&Rs I'd love to work with, Aaron Bashuk, Wendy Goldstein, you know, you find people that actually do believe in music and do love music, and it's like, okay, don't fucking quit, just keep going until you find the people that actually care.
This is probably naive, but I am pretty shocked to hear that a presumably a label executive asked you to be less gay.
Oh, all the time. People don't really understand how you know what I mention all the time, that, you know, to me it's so crazy that, you know, if you look at the of course there's amazing white straight male songwriters. Of course there are. But if you look at overall, the ones that have really like left a huge mark besides Max Martin, but he's Swedish, so it doesn't count. They're just the more enlightened people. When you look at the people that have really gone on these tears, you know, whether it's old school Carole King or whether it's Diane Warren or whether it's Desmond Child or whether it's Linda Perry or whether it's Julia Michaels or whether it's Justin Tranter, to, you know, talking in the third person, which is always classy. It's so many of them, or also The Dream, you know, who's, you know, a fucking amazing African-American dude. It's women, it's gay men, and it's men of color that really have left the biggest songwriting marks on this, on the industry. And I always think like, well, clearly this business is shockingly homophobic and misogynistic and still somewhat racist. Because if I was an executive, I would look at the history of the business, of the songwriters that really fuck shit up in a good way, and be like, wait a minute. They're all women or black or gay men or gay women even too. You're like, we should, every session should have one of those in there. But when you look and most sessions are just a bunch of white straight dudes, you realize, wow, this industry still has a very, very far way to go in terms of being open-minded. And what I'm so proud of with me and Julia is, you know, you have a young Mexican woman and a middle-aged gay man writing these songs, and you realize that even if the listeners have no idea who we are, which most of them don't, you can tell that they're looking for a different perspective. They're looking for something interesting because we're connecting to them for a reason. And point being, sorry, I can go off on tangents. Point being is that then you realize that the homophobia and the misogyny and the racism is still deeply rooted in this business. When the executives, even for their money, aren't looking at it going, wait, we should use more of these outside point of views. We should use more of not just the typical, because clearly people want it. So that's enough of that soapbox. Sorry.
Do you have friends in the industry, artists and songwriters who have been through the same thing as you? Is this sort of endemic of the actual entire industry?
Well, yeah, this has happened, you know, this happens a lot. I think, you know, but then of course, just to always be positive, there are, you know, A&Rs and other people in the business that don't give a fuck, and they just want whatever is the best song, and whoever it comes from, they don't care. And that's a good thing. You know, they just want the best music that they possibly can find. And obviously where my career is, these are barriers that you can break through. You know, I've proven it. You can make these things happen. But, you know, I mean, you look at, I don't know if you know the artist Fancy, but he's brilliant, songwriter, singer, everything. And, you know, his whole campaign was launched without showing his face. You know, you look at that and it's like, okay, well, this is an openly gay man, and we've decided to launch his whole thing by literally not letting anyone know who or what he is, what he looks like, what he lives like, what, who he loves, nothing. Very interesting that, like, that's still happening, you know, in 2000 something. So, you know, these things are still happening all the time. And the main thing, whenever I bring these conversations up in sessions, it's interesting. Like, well, no, but like, there's you, there's, you know, Jay Hart, there's, I mean, like, count. I'm like, if you have to count the amount of gay men and women in this business, like, there's a problem. You shouldn't, there should be so many of us that you can't count it. Like, that's a problem. And then also, I know a lot of people that stay in the closet still, in the music business. And like, in an artistic business, that people still have to be in the closet is really sad.
After all those years of being an artist, now being a successful songwriter, do you ever yearn to be an artist, especially when you hand over your songs, your babies, whether they be collaboratively created or not, to Justin Bieber or Britney or whoever else?
No, I don't. The process of being an artist is pretty brutal. And, you know, for me, the you know, back to the motto of creation over attention, it's just about, you know, saying something that you care about, even if it's fun and if it's, you know, Britney Spears' slumber party, that's just like fun and goofy and sexy, I still care about it. And, you know, it just feels good to, it feels good to give it away. The only time I ever, like if I went to the opera on Sunday and just like how visually stunning it was, I was like, oh, I'd like to be a part of something visual again, because everything I do now is just all what you hear. But it's not necessarily in wanting to be an artist. It's just that other side of creativity that sometimes I miss. But it's not, being an artist sucks. I'm just going to be honest. It's not fun. Performing is amazing. Touring is horrible. There's not one singer that enjoys touring because voices aren't meant for it. It's like asking a marathon runner to run a marathon 6 days a week. It's just crazy. A crazy thing to do. People tear you apart. People ask you the same four questions 27 times a day. It's not fun. It's a young person's game. It's not for me.
Pop hits are very much the backbone of streaming. From the perspective of someone who sees their songs rise to the top of like Spotify's global chart and then sees the check, you know, what are your feelings on what songwriters who write global pop smashes are paid currently, and what would you like to happen to that in the future?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think placing the blame on Spotify completely is wrong. You know, the labels have a deal with Spotify, and they're allowed to kind of hide those deals, and we don't really know how much money any of them are making. So it's not just Spotify, it's also the labels that aren't paying out the correct publishing, because we don't know how much publishing we should deserve from those songs because everything's hidden. We can see how many spins they have or plays they have or streams they have, whatever we're supposed to call it. But, you know, I think that Spotify is brilliant. I think that Spotify is the future of music. I think that what Spotify provides for the listener is unbelievable. And what Spotify provides for like some artist who is, you know, in the basement of their mom's house in Southern Illinois or some bullshit. I'm from Illinois. I can say that. It's amazing. The amount of exposure that people can just get from a song they made and in their basement and put it up through TuneCore or wherever. It's unbelievable. It's an amazing tool. It's finally someone was smart enough to figure out how to use the internet to the benefit of the music business, not to hinder it. And a lot of music business is making a shit ton of money off of Spotify, and Spotify is making a shit ton of money off the music business. Everyone needs to just get together and put their foot down and be nice and make sure that the money gets to the songwriters, because, you know, it's not like my life is amazing. You know, all I ever wanted to do was buy a house and like be able to take my friends to dinner. And I have that life now, and it's fucking awesome. I don't need an obscene amount of money. However, somebody in an office shouldn't be making that money instead of me, because I would rather have that money and like, you know, give it to Black Lives Matter. I would rather have that money and give it to make, you know, pay for my niece's college. It's not fair that somebody else is making that money. So that's where it gets weird, because it's like, well, hearing rich people complain about not being richer is never attractive, and it's disgusting. And, it, you know, I would never do that. But on the other hand, it's not fair that some executive who didn't write that song is making the money off of it instead. So that's where the issue, I think, lies. And everyone needs to come together, and everyone needs to figure out how to make sure that everyone's taken care of and the money is being dispersed correctly, and everyone's benefiting from this amazing tool called Spotify.
Why do you work so well with Julia?
I work so well with Julia because, one, she's fucking brilliant. And two, I think that I was just the time that I met her in my life. You know, Julia's a very alpha writer, which is why she's amazing. Even when we're writing for somebody else, you know, she's really telling her story, and she tells her story so clearly and so well that I think a lot of writers, their egos get in the way, and they want to make sure that their stamp is very loud on the song, that their personality and their point of view is very loud. You know, so then when you get two people fighting, and, you know, for to tell their specific story, you're just, it's going to, you're not going to get a great product. And I think by the time that I met her in my life, I had already been in my band for so long that I, you know, I had 10 years of saying, doing, singing, wearing, performing exactly what I wanted. So by the time I met her, it was just, I was so excited and ready to just help somebody else tell their story and help make somebody else's vision clearer. Even though we were writing for other people, she always writes as an artist. These are, you know, these are her, it's her blood in every song. And so, and now it's really amazing too that we're finally, we're working on her project. It's like watching her blossom in an even better way. And also too, you know, without everything I just said too, she's also, you know, when I say, I think we can make this better, or can we actually just completely do this whole other idea, she's still open to it. You know, she is such a real fan of music that, even if we're telling a story that is so specific to her and her personal life, if I bring something completely out of left field, she is 100% willing to explore it.
You must have hit so many of your ambitions now from when you went through the period of like, okay, I'm going to be songwriter Justin now. I want to ask, what ambitions do you have left for yourself in this business?
I mean, the ambitions I have left are still, I would love to just, you know, I mean, 2016 was such a, or 2015 and 2016 together were so insane that I'd love to see if I could pull off another like 2 years. If I can make 17 and 18 just as insane, that would be really cool because it's like a proof of staying power. Also, another thing, you know, every single songwriter or producer, they have that big hot moment that lasts for 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, and then they fall off again, and then they come back. I'd love to have that big comeback moment. So hopefully I can make the hot moment last another couple of years. But then inevitably, everyone, you know, it's an industry of trends, so things get hot and things get cold. So I'd love to have that moment where I get cold and then I fight back up again. That would be really cool. And then I think finally, it would just be, you know, to use every single second of success and exposure I have to make people more open-minded and more aware of the sort of systemic racism, misogyny, and homophobia that exists not only in the world but in the music business, and especially with what's happening in America right now, where we have actual Nazis being placed into the Oval Office. It's time to fight, and I always love a good fight, and I can't wait to use every ounce of power and money and exposure I have to make sure that the little kids growing up in this new regime know that there's people out there that love them and care about them and want them to be just as fabulous and as weird as they're meant to be.
Huge thanks to Justin for his time and thoughtful answers. And also thank you to Sound Exchange, the exclusive supporter of the MBW podcast. We'll be back next month interviewing another influential figure in the modern music business. See you then.